The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. By just about every measure, American millennials are less religious than their predecessors, so you'd think they might be less likely to support positions favored by the religious right. That's certainly the case when it comes to gay marriage, but not abortion. Ruth Graham is a regular contributor to Slate, where her article, The New Culture of Life, argues that a growing number of young pro-life activists are, or call themselves, secular. Ruth, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Great to be here.
So where do millennials stand on abortion compared to other issues that are largely in the realm of the religious right?
Yeah, it's really interesting because we're used to seeing every generation get more progressive on things like sexuality and drug law and things like that. But millennials, they fit pretty comfortably into the rest of the population. So 52% of them say the label pro-life applies to them. They're actually more conservative when it comes to things like favoring bans on late-term abortion. Pro-life millennial activists like to call themselves the pro-life generation. And, you know, when you ask people questions about abortion in different ways, you get a lot of different answers. So that probably is too simplistic, but they're certainly not definitively getting more progressive than the generations that came before them.
So calling themselves pro-life, but you spoke to the leaders of several different groups that are distancing themselves from the traditional pro-life movement. What did you find?
Yeah, exactly. So traditionally, as you said, the pro-life movement has been allied closely with the Republican Party and specifically with the religious right. So they found themselves working with people who also cared about things like sexuality, prayer in public schools, the kinds of issues that happen to be important to conservative, you know, late 20th century American Christians. This newer generation of activists, at least the ones that I spoke to, were sort of saying, listen, those issues really have nothing, no inherent connection to abortion. And they see abortion, they call it a life issue, and they see it as more connected to things like, unjust war, euthanasia, the death penalty, all these issues that have some connection to the idea of inherent, you know, an inherent value to all human life. And you can trace that idea back to Catholicism pretty easily. There's an idea of the seamless garment of life that was first articulated in the 1980s. But not all of these activists are Catholic or are even religious at all. That was another really interesting strain, is that a lot of them are, you know, hoping to sort of sever the idea that caring about abortion is only for conservative Christians.
So they don't want to be seen as religious or conservative Christian.
Yeah, exactly. So there's an organization, Secular Pro-Life, that is explicitly about this and is trying to sort of make space for pro-life activists to find each other and operate outside of church spaces and religious spaces and, you know, really making secular sort of human rights-based arguments about abortion.
So it is a more nuanced view, certainly, than the traditional pro-life view. But I'm wrestling with this question about being thought of as religious, because isn't it echoing a religious, a fundamentally religious or theological view that life begins at conception? I mean, that's not a secular view that, you know, a scientist would say a 2-month-old fetus is not a sustainable life, right? Is it more strategic not to be seen as religious?
I think the question of when life begins is fundamentally a religious or a philosophical question for anyone. So, is a fetus in the womb life? That depends on what you mean by life. Does it necessarily mean sustainable on its own, or does it mean something that is growing towards sustainability? Is an acorn life or is only an oak tree life? So these are fundamentally philosophical questions that have been you know, maybe wrestled with more in religious spaces. But I think when it comes down to it, you know, it is a philosophical question, no matter what your belief is.
They also don't want to be associated with the GOP necessarily. Are they voting for Trump? Did you hear that from?
You know, it was so interesting because, I started with that question sort of front of mind. And it's what I wanted to figure out first is what are pro-life voters doing when the Republican nominee is someone who has really not made a convincing case that abortion is an important issue to him at all. So he has sort of he's parroted some sort of lines from the pro-life movement, but he's really been incoherent on it over the course of his career and even very recently. So that was one of the most interesting questions to me. And it took me weeks of reporting to even find a pro-life voter, or, you know, a young pro-life voter who would talk to me about voting for Trump. And it was, you know, over time they sort of trickled in, and I did speak to a few people who had, I would say, kind of talked themselves into it by saying, well, you know, at least there's a chance he'll affect the Supreme Court. You know, at least knows he has to pander to us, basically. But there's really, really not a lot of enthusiasm for Donald Trump among this group.
So issues like the death penalty that you mentioned for secular pro-life, poverty issues, important, but are they spending time and resources on fighting that, or is abortion really the central cause?
Yeah, I would say abortion is the central cause, but that may not be totally fair because I was seeking out abortion activists. But I do think it's relevant to sort of look at what other political issues they see as connected to that cause, because it may say something about where other young people who are not activists but who think of themselves as pro-life, it may say something about what they value when they go into the voting booth.
Another distinction here, more women. I mean, in the traditional pro-life movement, there are not. It's, you know, has been criticized as a male movement, certainly. You spoke with a woman, the founder of New Wave Feminist, Destiny Herndon De La Rosa. This is not what we think of traditionally as feminism. You know, similar to a lot of conservatives have become single-issue voters on abortion, so have feminism for abortion rights.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see those lines scrambled, because I think this concept would be so foreign and even offensive to activists on both sides of this issue. You know, when you think back about sort of the 1980s abortion wars, so the idea that there would be self-described feminists being strong pro-life activists is really fascinating. And Destiny was saying, and I hope I'm not mangling her argument here, but a lot of the big feminist fights of the 60s, 70s, even 80s about women at work and things like that have been, you know, not won. I don't want to say that those issues are dead, but she's saying there's this whole new, category of, you know, basically patriarchal oppression when it comes to, you know, men wanting their girlfriends or wives to be on chemical birth control for decades, encouraging them to get abortions if they don't want to, discouraging them to have children. And again, I'm characterizing her argument, not my own. But this idea that, the pressure on women to kind of control their fertility in that way, she sees as an inherently a feminist cause.
We're speaking with Ruth Graham. She's a regular contributor to Slate, where she wrote about the new culture of life, a shift in millennial opinion or packaging of the pro-life movement. Well, Ruth, you cited this Public Religion Research Institute survey, right? And we dug into that just a little bit, as well as a Pew poll which found millennials to be pro-choice to the tune of 60%. I think a lot depends on what kind of questions you ask, you know, whether people find abortion morally acceptable, for example. Many don't. But that doesn't mean they're against abortion rights. So let's get a sense of what they're looking for, these groups, these young millennials, in terms of policy around abortion. Did you get a sense of that?
A little bit. And I certainly think if you asked these activists to write down the policies that they were in favor of, it would look pretty much like the traditional pro-life movement. So most of them support, the various state laws that have been cropping up recently to, restrict access to and, the ability of abortion clinics to operate. That's not that surprising, although I did speak to one college activist who was sort of lamenting the rhetoric around forcing Planned Parenthood clinics to close down because Planned Parenthood does so much more for women's health. And that's another arm of the feminist argument is sort of, you know, we need to be there for women, not just for fetuses. So there's a little bit of a nod, at least rhetorically, to some of those policies being problematic. But honestly, I don't think there's a big break there.
In fact, that's something that another writer, Amanda Marcotte of Salon, wrote in response to your piece, that some of the women that you spoke with on the record, seeing the sorts of things we're familiar with hearing from more traditional pro-life groups, they look different, she says, but they're not really different from their predecessors. What did you get a sense that this is just, you know, the old movement's new packaging?
I think it depends on how you look at it. So certainly from a political perspective, these are women that are still arguing for anti-abortion policies and for, you know, an anti-abortion culture. So if that's your priority, then this is not a huge shift. This isn't you know, pro-life women who dress like pro-choice women and are actually pro-choice. They really are pro-life. So they really sincerely oppose abortion. I asked one of the women, you know, ultimately, when it comes to it, would you force women to give birth who don't want to be pregnant? And she didn't have a great answer to that. And I think there is something, you know, when you kind of follow those ideas to their natural conclusion, there isn't a big difference to, you know, between this movement and the traditional movement. That said, I think the packaging is significantly different. I think the other issues that they see as connected to abortion, I think that's really significant. And I think that that could have really big implications for both the Republican and Democratic parties going forward. Because if you have this whole cohort of young people who care deeply about abortion, but don't see themselves as naturally fitting into, you know, every item on the Republican platform going forward, you know, in a few decades, is that going to force a sort of realignment or at least encourage it?
So adopting the language of feminism, not really changing root policies, which brings up how do traditional feminists think of this and how do traditional pro-life groups think of this new kind of secular skin?
So I think traditional feminists are pretty appalled by this. So, you know, Amanda Marcotte, that piece in Salon responding to this, you know, I think that that's pretty representative of saying, you know, wait, this is, you know, this is just wolves in sheep's clothing. And, you know, I think there's even a pretty widespread view that you can't be a feminist if you're pro-life or if you're anti-abortion, I should say. And then I think traditional pro-life activists are pretty welcoming toward this. I think it's exciting, first of all, to see, you know, this idea of the pro-life generation. It's exciting to see that young people are sort of making the movement their own. And I'm sure there's disagreement over some of these related policy issues. Certainly some leaders on the religious right, for example, a lot of the older religious right leaders have endorsed Trump, and a lot of these younger people are speaking out against him. So there's dissent and disagreement there. But at least, you know, the reaction I got to this piece, a lot of pro-life activists seem really excited about this.
Do you think by trying to reframe the issue, there's going to be a real effect on public opinion?
You know, that's interesting because what some of these women told me is like, listen, we care deeply about policy, but what we really need to do is change the culture and make abortion sort of unthinkable. And if you do that, you don't need to change policy. Now, I find that far-fetched that that's actually going to happen, but it's a really interesting concept. One of them brought up an old Supreme Court case, I want to say from the 1920s, that basically allowed for state-enforced sterilization of, quote-unquote, the unfit. And that ruling was never formally overturned, but it became so morally repugnant, so obviously just against contemporary ethics and morals that it would never happen today. And she was saying, listen, you know, if we change the culture, then we don't need to overturn Roe v. Wade. And we can sort of, you know, go about it from the cultural standpoint.
Ruth Graham, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Ruth Graham, a regular contributor to Slate, where you'll find her article, The New Culture of Life. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. desperate problems call for desperate measures. To stem the profitable illegal ivory trade, conservationists are getting creative with skydiving dogs. Yep, it's a program in South Africa making quick, stealthy canine drops into vast forests and parklands to chase poachers down before the thieves disappear into the bush. Janie Ackman is research assistant with National Geographic. She wrote for Nat Geo's Wildlife Watch blog about the parachuting dogs that could help prevent the killing of wildlife for profit. And Janie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So skydiving dogs sounds pretty extreme. Give us a sense of the scope of the problem.
So the problem is pretty bad right now. Just to give you a sense of the scale of the poaching problem, wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion dollar business. It's right up there with drug trafficking, human trafficking, and animals are just being decimated across Africa so that their parts can be sold off and used as medicine, food, jewelry, souvenirs, and it's really affecting some of the more iconic species in Africa, like elephants and rhinos, for example. Elephants are really facing a poaching crisis right now. 27,000 savanna elephants are killed a year for their ivory. We're losing about 8% of elephants every year, and most of that is due to poaching. And most of the ivory ends up in China, where it's viewed as a status symbol. And it's the same thing for rhinos, too. So last year, we lost about 1,300 rhinos in Africa. They're killed for their horns. And their horns are also viewed as a status symbol in countries like China and Vietnam. And it's carved into objects, artwork, used erroneously in traditional medicine.
So now the tactic of parachuting dogs from helicopters strapped to humans, what can these dogs do that sentries patrolling or surveilling the forest cannot?
So dogs have a different skill set than humans. They have a heightened sense of smell. So they're being taught to sniff out elephant ivory, ammunition, weapons, and poachers themselves. They're faster than us, so they can track down these poachers better than we can. And a lot of times, national parks are in mountainous areas, they're in the bush, and these dogs can navigate through some of that really difficult terrain a lot better than us humans can. So these dogs are really an added tool for rangers on the ground in national parks in Africa that already have a really difficult job trying to track down poachers.
So this is happening now? Dogs are doing this? How many?
So there are only two dogs right now that have been taught in this program to skydive out of helicopters. And they actually haven't done this yet in the real world. This is just part of the training program. The training program wants to teach more dogs how to do this. And the purpose is for the dogs eventually to be deployed into national parks across Africa after they're finished with the training program so they can actually do this in the real world.
Who's behind this?
The program is run by a defense contractor called Paramount Group. It is a company based in Johannesburg, South Africa, which is where the training program is also based.
Defense contractor. So somebody's paying. How much does it cost and who is paying?
I'm actually not entirely sure how much money is going into this program. I do think that it is very resource-intensive program. So they're actually breeding the dogs at the center in addition to training them. So you can just imagine how many resources that would take. It's veterinarians, instructors, and also the helicopters. So it is a resource-intensive program.
Well, I have watched the videos. They're pretty thrilling. And there's one posted along with your story on Nat Geo. One of the dogs, Arrow, he's parachuting. Well, it's actually rappelling, I guess. They're not dropping free fall, but off of ropes. So do the dogs appear to enjoy it?
I've actually been told that they really enjoy it. So these two dogs in particular, Arrow and Giant, are the only ones that have gone skydiving. And I've been told that they really get excited by it. Even just the roar of a helicopter alone or just seeing the harness that they're going to be strapped into is enough to get them excited. And that's really part of it, because not every dog is well suited for helicopter work. They really try and pick the dogs that seem to enjoy it and that have really excelled in in doing repelling work. Because if a dog doesn't seem to enjoy being in a helicopter, obviously they may not enjoy the skydiving process.
And this is not the only canine program being used to protect wildlife in Africa. So what else is out there?
So dogs are increasingly being used as a tool to help rangers in national parks. There is a program in Tanzania run by Big Life Tanzania, which is a conservation organization. And they're doing things that are similar to this Johannesburg-based training program. They're teaching the dogs to track down and sniff out poachers. There is a program in Kenya run by African Wildlife Foundation, teaching dogs to sniff out elephant ivory at airports. And I know that they've had some success. National Geographic actually ran a story about that back in April. And I believe that at the time they had participated in about 18 ivory trafficking busts.
Well, Janie, thank you for telling us about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Janie Ackman, she's a writer and researcher for National Geographic's blog Wildlife Watch. And you can find a link to her article, Dogs Are Now Parachuting from the Sky to Help Save Wildlife, and watch the video for yourself. It is absolutely thrilling. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Aedes aegypti is the mosquito species that carries Zika, the virus causing critical birth defects in babies born in Central and South America and spreading fast. But Aedes aegypti was actually wreaking havoc on humanity long before Zika. For thousands of years, the species has been spreading other diseases like dengue and yellow fever. And as it happens, one man set out to eradicate this deadly insect 80 years ago and was ridiculed for it. Reporter Jake J. Smith brings us the story of Fred Soper and his crusade against mosquitoes.
Fred Soper is living in Rio de Janeiro when the outbreak hits.
June 5th, 1928. Newspapers in North have reported 70 cases in Rio. June 14th, wild rumors are heard that Bahia is full of yellow fever.
No one had seen it coming, says science historian Nancy Lee Stepan.
That was a total surprise. The Brazilians had a very good record, actually, of controlling yellow fever.
And in Soper's opinion, the outbreak could have been prevented. Brazil's health department hadn't been vigilant enough about monitoring yellow fever, he thinks. It was a failure of administration. But if there's one thing Fred Soper can do, it's administrate. He just spent 7 years organizing health campaigns in Brazil and Paraguay, fighting hookworm disease with the Rockefeller Foundation. And he didn't get the nickname the Commander for nothing.
He had a very upright bearing, a mustache. He looked rather like a soldier. He conducted himself rather like not just a soldier, I would say, but a general.
Shortly after the outbreak, Brazil's yellow fever service is reorganized under Soper's command. And to him, the path forward is clear. With hard work and organization, he thinks that he can eradicate yellow fever for good. He just needs to figure out how. It's common knowledge that the disease is carried by the Aedes aegypti mosquito. And there are brigades of inspectors who go around patrolling for these bugs. So, for 3 months, Soper follows these inspectors all around the northeast of Brazil, going from house to house, destroying the mosquito's breeding places, keeping meticulous records. And this, Soper comes to think, is how you eradicate a disease. Soon he sends brigades to do the same thing all across Brazil.
He had this idea of the perfection of public health administration, that you could achieve your goals if you were completely perfect in everything that you did. And since the world is not perfect, things did go wrong.
Things promptly go wrong. For a long time, everyone had thought that yellow fever could only exist in mosquitoes or in humans. But a few years after the outbreak, they discovered that monkeys living in rainforests can also harbor yellow fever, which means the only way to truly eradicate the disease would be to exterminate all the monkeys, which no one is eager to do. This puts a kink in Soper's plan. Up until now, eradicating the disease yellow fever has been his main goal. With that no longer possible, he starts to change his focus. It was an idea that had been stirring in his mind for years.
April 13th, 1927. Some thoughts that came to me this morning.
Maybe he can't eradicate yellow fever, but...
Is it possible to exterminate Aedes aegypti in limited control areas?
What if instead he eradicated the mosquito that causes it?
It seems to me to be worth investigation.
It seems paradoxical in a way, because you give up the eradication of a disease and you transfer your ideas of eradication to the insect. Insects are extremely difficult animals to think of eradicating. They are some of the most successful animals in the world.
That's because they're small and good at adapting. Mosquitoes, for example, have been around since the Jurassic period and are found on every continent but Antarctica. Still, Soper's idea isn't totally off the wall. It's based on the fact that in a city like Rio de Janeiro, if you can get to the point where 5% of houses or less have these mosquitoes, that'll be enough to prevent yellow fever from spreading. But then that scientific fact gets distorted through Soper's perfectionist lens. He starts to realize if you do a good enough job to kill 95% of mosquitoes, you're going to end up killing 100% of mosquitoes. So why not just aim for complete success?
And then he became converted to the idea, well, we could eradicate this mosquito. And if we did that, we would no longer have yellow fever epidemics at all.
Now let's be clear. There are other ways to control yellow fever, and Soper is choosing a really ambitious, really difficult path. There's a world of difference between controlling a disease and eradicating a species from a country of 3 million square miles, like Brazil. Disease experts mock him for this. Insect experts remind him that those last 5% of mosquitoes will be nearly impossible to find. Even the Rockefeller Foundation, who he works for, thinks that eradicating a mosquito isn't what they came here to do. None of which matters to Fred Soper.
He was very, very convinced that he had the answer.
The Aegypti mosquito was now the enemy rather than yellow fever. The eradication of Aegypti would prevent not only yellow fever, but also dengue and any other Aegypti-transmitted disease.
And this plan soon receives a government sanction. In October 1930, shortly after Soper takes over the National Yellow Fever Program, there's a revolution in Brazil. Getúlio Vargas overthrows the elected government in a coup.
He was an authoritarian, often called the Mussolini of Brazil.
Soper quickly calls a meeting with this new leader, and they hit it off. Vargas gives Soper permission to do whatever he needs to do. And this is when Soper's dream of eradication starts to look feasible. Now, all over the country, his mosquito brigades are allowed to fumigate people's houses with insecticide. If they find mosquitoes breeding in a house, they get to impose fines on the owners. When someone in a suspect area dies of unknown causes, Soper sends a worker to the funeral where they cut out a chunk of the deceased person's liver to be biopsied, with or without the family's permission. At one point, a newspaper calls this new set of laws draconian, and one of Soper's colleagues suggests that the government should censor such criticism.
But I pointed out that it was draconian, and the fact should be well known before the service started to enforce it.
And all of this seems to work.
By 1940, six states and the city of Rio de Janeiro were on the eradicated list.
Now, at this point, they've actually developed a vaccine for yellow fever. But Soper still insists that mosquito eradication is the way to get rid of the disease in the long term. And in his defense, that seemingly impossible goal is looking more and more likely every year.
The first serious proposal that I leave Brazil had come shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor.
World War II begins, and the U.S. Army calls on Soper for his expertise. So, with his eradication campaign in Brazil firmly on the right track, Soper leaves. He spends the next 4 years fighting malaria in Egypt, preventing typhus in Italy, experimenting with the use of DDT. He saves millions of lives. But through all of this, eradicating Aedes aegypti remains in the back of his mind. This goal that's just within reach. After the war, Soper is appointed the director of the Pan American Sanitary Bureau, and he sees his chance to make eradication happen not just in Brazil, but across the American continent.
And he sets this in motion and literally crisscrosses the Americas, trying to make governments commit themselves to achieving this end.
He succeeds. Country after country sets up programs like the one he'd been running in Brazil. After 10 years, in 1958, for the first time ever, the WHO certifies entire countries free of Aedes aegypti. There's Brazil and Bolivia and Belize.
The Canal Zone, Ecuador, French Guiana.
Nicaragua, Panama.
Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay.
After this, even more countries sign on. And Soper becomes the godfather of eradication. This crazy idea of his is actually catching on. He lectures to medical students and health workers, saying things like,
"Administration is the essence of eradication."
And,
"He who rides the tiger may not dismount, so long as the tiger lives."
Because even as the concept of eradication is spreading across the continent, Soper is terrified that it's all going to come crashing down, as he should be.
When you get to a very low rate, when the mosquito becomes almost invisible, is precisely when public health agencies tend to give up. And as a consequence, almost inevitably, the mosquito comes back.
August 22nd, 1967. Dear Paolo, the most immediate reason for this note is the news of the reinfestation of Belém do Pará with Aedes aegypti. It is especially important that Brazil move immediately.
By 1967, Soper is very shocked to discover that a large area of northeastern Amazon is infected by the insect. And by that time, Brazil had lost its certification as free of Aedes aegypti. So it had got it, and then it had lost it.
What happened? Once these countries were certified aegypti-free, it was hard to convince their leaders to keep dedicating time and money to these programs. Plus, it's hard to say today whether they were ever truly eradicated in the first place. In other words, Soper's detractors had been proven right. And the public health community, which had recently made a hero out of Soper, starts to turn against him. The next year, the director of the CDC publishes a lecture questioning whether the eradication of Aedes aegypti, Soper's holy grail, is still worth pursuing. He points out that it hasn't worked, that they have vaccines against yellow fever, and can they really keep asking these small, poor countries in Central America to pour money into eradication if there are better, cheaper options? Soper responds in turn.
"I cannot remain silent in the face of these surprising proposals."
And he doubles down on his failed strategy. "Stay the course," he says. "We've been free of yellow fever for so long."
"The long-term continuation of this freedom must be based on the recognition of Aedes aegypti as the enemy to be feared."
It's a refrain he'll continue repeating for another 9 years, to increasingly deaf ears, as country after country disbands its eradication program. In 1977, Fred Soper dies in Wichita, Kansas, not far from his birthplace. No longer a laughingstock, no longer a hero, but somewhere in between.
This is the pest that's causing the Zika virus problems.
There's no vaccine against the Zika virus, so controlling it comes down to controlling the mosquito that carries the virus.
We have created a strain of Aedes aegypti, which is the mosquito that spreads dengue and Zika virus. We release males into the environment, and when those males mate with females, the offspring inherit the gene and they die.
Nowadays, it's awfully tempting to say that Fred Soper knew something we didn't, like that Aedes aegypti wasn't done with us.
Of course, he was quite wrong in one very important regard, is you can't eradicate, he could not eradicate an insect.
That's science historian Nancy Lee Stepan again.
So he has not been vindicated in his eradicationist goals. Is his determination, his conviction of the importance of getting the details right and so on, has that been confirmed? Yes, I think in many respects it has been. It takes a certain kind of person to do that work well, and he did it well.
Eradication seems like such a sleek, perfect solution. New technologies like genetically engineered mosquitoes threaten to make Sopers out of all of us. The question is, which Soper will we become? The commander, who is diligent administrating saved countless lives? Or the authoritarian, whose devotion to an idea blurred his good sense? In the age of Zika, we may find out soon enough.
Word of mouth!
This is Jodi Pico with the 10-Minute Writers Workshop.
And I'm Virginia Prescott, welcoming you to our 30th 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast with the phenomenally successful Jodi Pico. Small Great Things is her 24th novel and the 9th straight to debut at number 1 on the New York Times bestsellers list. If Pico has a thing, it's writing about thorny ethical issues from the perspectives of multiple characters and always a twisty ending. She's written in the voice of suicidal teens and rape victims and a school shooter, but until now never as a Black character and never directly confronting racism, privilege, and inequity in America, which most people avoid talking about. We caught up with her in the green room at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, before she joined me for Writers on a New England Stage. I asked our standard icebreaker, which is harder to write, the first sentence or the last?
Totally the first sentence, because I always know where the book is headed. I don't always know the last line, like John Irving apparently does, but I know that I'm not allowed to let myself write until I can feel that first sentence in my head.
So you said you know what's coming. Is it all plotted out pretty well for you before you even sit down to write?
I always know the beginning of a book, and I know the end of a book. How I get from A to Z, though, is up to the characters. So I don't really plot the books. I just sort of know where I'm starting and where I'm headed.
When do you share your writing? How far in?
I actually share it in process. So my first readers are always my mom and my agent. My agent, because she has a big picture view and, you know, can actually give me critical feedback. And my mom, because she's a benchmark reader. She has to laugh and cry and get upset at all the right places.
If you're starting with a sort of idea of where you want to go, how much does that idea change as you go along, as you said, as the characters dictate?
It really depends on the book. Because I tend to write about things that are worrying me and keeping me up at night and things that I need to wrestle through, which is sort of the point of writing a novel for me, I often pick a controversial issue and I think I know what my response is going to be to that issue. And very often, I may not change my opinion about a topic, but I'll change my reasons for it. What sometimes happens, though, is that characters do develop and become their own people and start to walk away from you. And if you're really smart, you just hold on to the reins and let it go. And I've had characters have life circumstances change that I never expected, you know. And to me, that's the fun part of writing, when a character throws you as an author for a loop.
You're known for writing about things that are very contemporary, like, as you said, things that keep you up at night. What is that process like? Do some things stick and others don't?
More importantly, something that doesn't stick this year might stick very hard 2 years from now. So I have a whole box full of things that I'm worried about or thinking about or news stories that really made me sit and think or get upset. And sometimes if I ever run dry, I could sift through them and really see, like you said, you know, what rises to the surface. You know, for example, with this particular book, Small Great Things, this is not the first time I tried to write about racism. And yet I couldn't seem to find the right way to tell the story or explain to myself if I had the right to tell this particular story until now.
2016 seems like a really good time to be telling this story.
Yeah, well, I think so too.
You put out a book a year. So do you work on a really tight schedule? Is it a daily schedule, an annual schedule? How do you plot that out?
I put out a book a year for about 22 years, and then I put out a book every 2 years, which was nice because it meant I could actually take a vacation during the year. For me, it's very regimented, and most of it is because when you do publish a book and you're promoting that book, that is a certain amount of time that you are not home, you are not writing, you are not thinking about writing. You're basically thinking about staying upright for 3 months as you do a world book tour. That leaves you 9 months in which to write a book if it's you're on a yearly process. And so it depends on the book. There are sometimes that research can be done in 3 months, and there are sometimes it takes, you know, 7 or 8 months to get everything you need before you can sit down and begin to write. For Small Great Things, it took me almost an entire year to do the research, and I had over 1,200 pages of notes when I sat down to write.
So how about rituals, like, you know, anything that you have to do before you write or do during your writing or when things feel a little fallow?
I have a really awesome husband, and he brings me the best cup of coffee on the planet every day. I can't say that that fuels me, but it sure helps, and I miss it dreadfully when I'm away from home. I usually start my morning by exercising, and then when I get to my desk, it's about 7:30 in the morning, I have that cup of coffee, and often I just don't leave that desk until about 4:30.
How about the fact that you write about a lot of contemporary issues like this book, the Trayvon Martin case? Everything that's happened in the Black Lives Matter movement, do you worry about how that will age?
No, because, you know, although this feels particularly relevant right now to be talking about racism in 2016, the reality is this has been relevant for the past 200 years. The only difference is that we are in an age of 24/7 news cycles and social media. So when microaggressions play out, or macroaggressions in the case of the shooting of unarmed black men by police, we see it in real time. And so it feels particularly timely right now. But I actually would argue that that's a fallacy, that this has been timely for a very long time.
How about for new writers? What do you think is the most common mistake? And if you remember this from your own, the beginnings of your own career, most common mistake that new writers make?
The most common mistake I think new writers make is quitting. You know, very often you're in the middle of a short story or a novel and you suddenly look down and realize you have written the worst piece of literature in the history of mankind. And most people throw it out and say, you know, I can't do this anymore. That's a really bad thing. It's actually a psychological hurdle that you've hit when that happens. The reason you're not finishing is because what happens if you do finish and you're not as good a writer as you thought you were? That's terrifying. So what I always encourage people to do is to push through it, finish whatever you started, and then decide whether you want to fix it or scrap it. Because if you don't finish all the way to the end, you will never believe that you can, and you never actually will finish anything.
So fear of success / fear of failure.
Yeah, totally.
Is there a book or a work of art or something that made you want to be a writer?
When I was 13, I read Gone with the Wind for the first time. I used to act out parts as both Rhett and Scarlett, which is why I didn't have a boyfriend till I was 15. And I loved that book. I loved the way that Margaret Mitchell had created an entire world out of words. I could taste it. I could smell it. I could see it. And I distinctly remember the moment that I kind of stopped reading and thought, I could do that.
That's very telling that you acted out both parts. So what is the best piece of advice that you ever received about writing?
It came from my mentor, who was Mary Morris. She was my teacher at Princeton University in their creative writing program, and I would not be doing what I'm doing if not for her. And one of the things she said, which will probably make no sense unless you were in her workshop, was you can't write about the dinosaurs until they become oil. And what she meant was, you know, very often when we feel something very deeply emotionally or if something happens to us that we want to channel into fiction, we're too close to it. You have to be able to push it away long enough to be able to dissect it. And that was a very important message for me. That and if you are madly in love with a sentence in something you've written, it's probably the sentence you're going to wind up cutting.
Yeah. How about the worst advice?
Probably the worst advice was,
write what you know.
Yeah, you know, it really was, because I don't write anything I know. You know, we were told that when I started out in creative writing, and I remember thinking, you know, I honestly have nothing to write about. I grew up in suburbia. My parents are happily married. I have a little brother and I like him. You know, there was just nothing in my family that screamed angst. And I didn't know where to go with that. I did make a conscious choice to write the things I was willing to learn instead.
What's on your nightstand now?
Well, right now, my nightstand will have a Kindle on it because my nightstand is different every night on a book tour. But the book that I'm in the middle of reading is An Advanced Galley of Chris Bojalian's The Sleepwalker, and it's great so far.
Great. How about fantasy job other than writer?
Oh, this is a great question. I would be a pastry chef. Yes.
Really?
Yes, because I love baking, and my husband doesn't like it when I bake because he loves eating. But I really like it. I have a great time, and when it's the holidays, my son Kyle and I are always in the kitchen together making something.
Anything that goes well with coffee.
Right, exactly. Perfect. That's why we're the perfect match.
Jodi Picco, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jodi Picco just got about 40 million books in print worldwide, but says her newest, Small Great Things, was one of the hardest to write. The Washington Post called it her most important novel yet. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop is a production of NHPR, produced by Sarah Plourd with help from Maureen McMurray. There are now 30 workshops with creativity prods from the likes of Stacey Schiff, Andre Debuse III, Joe Hill, and other nonfiction, literary fiction, commercial fiction, and genre fiction writers. And you won't miss a one when you subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. And you'll get instant writing practice when you leave a review, which helps spread the ideas and the love. We're so grateful for your support. So glad to have you along with us on our daily respite from the news of the day. And next time on Word of Mouth, we're going to have a conversation with two writers, Colson Whitehead with the National Book Award winning The Underground Railroad, and Ben Winters, whose book is called Underground Airlines. They're both speculative works on the subject of slavery, kind of hopping over historical fiction into speculative fiction. Hope you'll join us for that. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Franco Luzzi, Tyler Gibbons, and Broke for Free. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.